This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 431 for August 17th of 2018. The show about shows. Auto shows, that is. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, Gary, we get to do another show.
I know, it's been a long time since we've been in the studio.
It has been.
We were off last week, and then we were in Traverse City the week before that.
The week before that, so it's been at least 3 weeks since we've been
here. Seems like a very long time.
And you've been out traveling. You just got back from the coast.
Yeah, driving the Honda Pilot, the 2019 Honda Pilot, which had a mid-cycle refresh.
And, maybe we can talk about that later.
Last week we were in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, driving the Silverado.
Silverado. We can talk about that, too, later in the show.
This is an important on this day. But we should introduce our guest. Then we'll go to the on this day, and then we'll go back to his subject.
Okay. Our special guest today is Craig Ehrlich. He's a senior VP at George P. Johnson. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay. A lot of people have never heard of George P. Johnson. In a nutshell, what's the company do?
In a nutshell, we are the premier and the largest event and experience marketing company in the world.
Which means what?
It means we power brand experiences for all brands around the world.
Doing events, right?
Events, creating experiences, you know, everything from the original strategy of how to connect to consumers, press, the public, you name it, all the way to measuring that and making sure that we're delivering.
I was astonished to learn the company's what? Over 100 years old, right?
We were founded in 1914.
That's unreal.
And we were founded as a sail manufacturer, of all things.
Oh, here we've got some video running of some of the experiences that you guys create.
Okay, a sail for sailing boats?
For sailing boats, exactly.
Okay, that was George P. Johnson's calling in life was to make sails?
Well, that's what he was doing at the time. And that morphed into manufacturing flags. And in fact, you may remember the Hudson's Building, and there was the world's largest flag hung from that Hudson's Building starting in 1923.
And it still exists, that big flag,
it
right?
It does. It's in the Smithsonian right now.
No kidding.
And it's very heavy because it's made of wool. But that's where...
And how big is it? I mean, I don't know if you know the dimensions or not, but I know it's gigantic.
Well, you remember the size of the Hudson's Building.
Yeah. So for the non-Detroiters who are watching, because we have people all over the world, Hudson's was a department store, very major department store, which was founded in Detroit. And so their flagship building was in downtown Detroit where this giant flag was.
In fact, the second largest department store in the country at the time. Mm-hmm.
And there are some of those out there in the audience that may have never heard of the Hudson's department store, but they may have heard of the Hudson car. Mm-hmm. Same family, same name. So anyway, George P. Johnson made flags. He made this gigantic Hudson's flag.
Yeah.
Then what?
Yeah. Well, in making flags and dealing with fabric and sewing, he was asked to help to bring about a change, a disruption, if you will, in the automotive business and the way in which cars were marketed. And George P. Johnson was kind of the initial organization to bring what we know today as the auto show.
Really? I mean, that was his idea to start doing shows?
Or? The manufacturers, of course, were driving how they wanted to market their brands. Mm-hmm. But George P. Johnson, from literally inventing the turntable to, you know, creating today experiences, interactive experiences that engage consumers in ways that we never would have imagined, you know, 104 years ago.
Well, I've seen pictures of car shows from that era, and it's just cars on a carpet. There wasn't anything that special, at least not to my 21st century eyes. What was he doing differently then?
Well, at that time, you know, there was very little that was being done to market a vehicle. We were democratizizing the vehicle, right? So in doing that, it's like to just own a vehicle, right? What was Henry Ford's famous quote about you can have the car in every color? as long as it's black.
Right.
So this was the beginning of time in helping to really demonstrate for consumers features and benefits. All right.
So was the company founded in Detroit?
Yes.
So basically, a real guy, a real individual, George P. Johnson.
That's him.
Okay, he establishes his company in Detroit at basically the same time when there were a number of, you know, J.L. Hudson entrepreneurs that were getting into the automobile business. And so he probably knew those guys and hung around with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they probably looked at him and said, well, you're the marketing guy. Tell us what we ought to be doing in terms of presenting our products to the public. Is that pretty much what happened?
Sounds like a good story.
Okay, we'll go with it.
We'll go with it, right.
Yeah.
So over the years, I mean, so I would have thought, until I looked into it, that basically the company created exhibits that were basically static exhibits, like a set, like we're on right now. I mean, and that was, but there would be cars instead of the three of us, right? There'd be three cars.
Yes.
But it's more than that you guys are now doing in order to provide messaging for the auto companies. Could you explain how you go about doing that?
Absolutely. And you're right on. I mean, for many years, fabrication and the actual stand itself was what was important. Today, what's important is the journey that the consumer has through your brand. Through the brand of the manufacturer. And certainly architecture is important when it comes to that, but so is the ability to really immerse yourself in the brand. And today, when you go to a show, you'll see all kinds of different techniques to do that, whether that's engaging virtual reality, augmented reality, being able to get into the cars, simulating kind of rides and things of that nature. It's a completely different experience. And by the way, we're talking about auto shows, which is very relevant to this, but really that is 30% of the business that George P. Johnson does. As the largest event and experiential marketing company in the world, we're creating experiences for all kinds of industries and all kinds of activations.
So you say 30% is auto shows, and you just touched on some of the others. Is it conventions or whatever in other industries, or fill in the blank? What all do you do?
Sure. Another large vertical market for us is the IT sector. So in the IT sector, we do, we look at everything as an experience. And so in that experience, we do a lot of conventions. We do a lot of large-scale activations. And we work with some of the, most well-known tech companies in the world, from IBM to Google to Cisco to insert the blank. And so as one example, a client we have on the West Coast is Salesforce. And every year they have a conference called Dreamforce, where they have up to 170,000 registrants that come and effectively take over the city of San Francisco. And we've helped Salesforce to reimagine what a conference looks like in a more experiential way.
Oh, very interesting. Here's a Right Night 70 wrote in to say, bring back the traveling auto show. Pressure the automakers to do more wild concepts, even concepts of what dead brands would be building presently. So what do you think about that from an experiential standpoint? A traveling auto show? I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, today in the U.S., there's 66 auto shows. Mm. So effectively, it does travel.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not traveling into a fixed destination of one of those 66, there are plenty of manufacturers today, and we're involved in some of those programs, that have mobile tours that are bringing their vehicles and the show, if you will, to places that maybe consumers can't reach.
Mm-hmm. So what is an experiential event versus a non-experiential event? I mean, how do you differentiate these?
Well, as a consumer, you're getting to experience the brand. I'm not walking into the cars on the carpet and open the door and, see what's in there. I'm actually getting a chance to experience what it's like to own the vehicle. And there's a variety of tools that we'll use to help those consumers and help those brands to create something that's more experiential. So I mentioned, some of the VR experiences. It can really give you a feel for what it's like to be on the road. Mm-hmm. And then you take it to the next level. For example, one of our signature programs that we run for FCA is called Camp Jeep. You've probably been, right? So you know a little bit about that. This gives consumers a chance to actually get inside the vehicle and see what it does, mm-hmm. right? Climb the mobile mountain that we bring, get on the wedges, bounce up and down on the stairs. And it's really incredible to be able to have an experience like that that you could normally not have mm-hmm. By just, opening up an app
right.
or seeing an ad on the TV. Experiential marketing is the fastest growing sector of all marketing. Mm-hmm. And as, television and other things decrease, and we all talk about digital, which is a very important, medium, which is always integrated. Experiential, touches all of them, but experiential is growing just as fast.
Mm-hmm. Craig, what do you make then of where auto shows have got to go? They're all hurting. I mean, whether you can talk Frankfurt, Detroit, Geneva, Paris. They're losing exhibitors. The public day is doing pretty good in all of them.
Yeah.
But from a media and exhibitor standpoint, it's going down. How do you take that experiential kind of approach that you're talking about and sprinkle that on auto shows?
Sure. Well, and the Detroit Auto Show is doing just that by making the change that they're making. And the time of year and the format that they're going to.
Did they consult you guys on what to do?
I'm not at liberty to share that information.
Okay.
No, I think, Rod Alberts and his team are being very thoughtful in the way in which they're going about recreating what the Detroit Auto Show is going to look like. GPJ is in a very unique position in that, a third of our business is in this automotive sector, and another third or more is in that tech sector. And so we're in a very unique position to be melding the tech world and the automotive world, which is what is happening in automotive mm-hmm. as well. And so we have been asked and will continue to be asked by our clients, which is a unique position for us to be in. Right? It's a competitive advantage to help to bring those learnings to the automotive sector. So I mentioned Dreamforce earlier. That's a festival. It used to be a business conference. And Salesforce came to us and said, can you help us to make this more of a festival like South by Southwest? So that's where auto shows are starting to go as well, mm-hmm. right? And we're very well positioned to support that. And we believe that that's that experiential kind of event is where auto shows will go. Now, there's a variety of different levels of auto shows, right? On the regional and the local level, that's where the purchase funnel is at the very bottom and sales are being made. And you go up where you're looking about, you're talking about perception and awareness, international shows and tier one shows. That's a place for media. And so what's going to change there is, or what is already changing there is the media and the OEMs taking the media off-site, mm-hmm. both either during the show or outside of the show to launch vehicles. We were talking earlier about your travel schedule.
But doesn't that hurt the auto show when they're taking them off-site?
It does. It does hurt the auto show, which is one of the reasons why you see some of the manufacturers not going to Paris, not going to Geneva, not going to Detroit, mm-hmm. because they're launching those vehicles in different places, right? They're launching them in video games. Right? They're launching them in all different unusual places. And so it's incumbent upon the shows to create a space where there's value and where, whether it's the media or otherwise, can actually experience and report on, of course, the launch.
It's interesting. We use the word show, okay? When we think about it, we just think of, cars on a carpet pretty much and maybe some nice booth design, and that's pretty much it. But, if you get back to it, if we talked about, I'm going to go to Broadway, and you'd say, what show are you going to see? Because it is an entertaining event, right? Yeah. And that show business seems to have gone out of the auto shows in some regards. Is it, your role to rejuvenate that sort of thing, to make it more exciting, to make it more engaging and informative at the same time? Because, if somebody's going to be plunking down $35,000 to buy something, they probably want to know more than a passing bit about it.
Yeah, it is. That is part of our role. And that's what we're doing every day to help OEMs essentially to bridge the gap between the show and the dealership, the sale effectively, because that's what we're all here to do, right? Sell cars. And in order to do that, how do you create an experience? How do you create loyalty for a particular brand? Well, it's in the way in which you experience that brand. And by the way, it doesn't just stop at the show. There's work that we're helping our clients to do before the show, during the show, after the show.
So, you know, you were mentioning you guys working with the tech industry and bringing some of that to automotive. And I thought I read one of the case studies that you guys have presented about how they did Aptiv at CES. And, you know, so the former part of Delphi that is now into autonomous vehicles and said that you had three strategic goals: launch the Aptiv brand to customers, prospects, media, investor, and government officials, drive new business growth, influence key pursuits, and open doors to new partnerships, and solidify Aptiv's thought leadership position. And I thought, wow, what a fascinating thing that here is a new company, essentially, that's in the automotive space, going to the, you know, the premier technology show, and you guys came up with ideas for them to accomplish these three things. Tell us about what you did. I mean, it is very cool.
Yeah, well, that was a very special program for GPJ, and specifically for our Detroit office, which I'm the general manager of, because we were the creators of that and as part of the GPJ family. But first, let me say that you know, tech shows, which you reference in CES, have become a major place for the automotive manufacturers to exhibit and to engage. And it doesn't just stop there. In addition to auto shows, they're looking, and we're helping them to find other places to integrate their products in an experiential manner. Tech shows, lifestyle events, South by Southwest. We've launched many vehicles at South by Southwest.
Big automotive presence there.
Big automotive presence. Brand experience centers, you know, they're all over the world now. And so there's a variety of ways that the manufacturers are now utilizing different tools to do that. So in particular in CES, they felt, you know, technology is a core function of what Aptiv is doing and what they're all about inside of the vehicle. And so what better place to launch what they were doing? We specifically actually took the program outside of the convention center, and we're in an adjacent space where we constructed, it was a tent, but really a pavilion more than anything else, and it really blew away all objectives.
We've got a number of questions coming in. Barry Rector from Indy says, what do you think about the North American International Auto Show moving from January to June?
Well, I think it was incumbent upon the show to do something different, because we were getting to a point where it wasn't, you know, it was very questionable whether it would survive. So moving from January to June, from a perspective of the city of Detroit, I think it's an unbelievable change. We are going to be able to, you know, how many journalists experience Detroit in 7 inches of snow and freezing weather and say, why would I go there? And the truth is, we have beautiful summers in Michigan. So for the city of Detroit, which is on a magnificent renaissance, this is going to be a terrific thing. For the show itself, to be able to change it up and to get outside, another amazing change. The question is going to be, how will the journalists react? And the timing is interesting, right? We're kind of through the season. So I don't know if it's the beginning of the season or the end of the season.
I don't think there is a season anymore, to be honest. There's seasons of weather. And if you go back far enough, there was the traditional fall reveal of all the new models. That's been gone for decades. Right. So I don't know is that it really matters.
Yeah. You're probably right. And when the vehicles are ready to launch, I think the manufacturers will find the shows in which it is most appropriate to launch, which is why we see some manufacturers saying, I'm not going to go to Paris. If they don't have something meaningful to share, they're making decisions about where they're spending the money.
I know, and you're absolutely right, but if I'm a member of the public who wants to go to one auto show, I want to see everything. I don't want, you know, somebody to drop out. I want to see it all. Even if I am not going to buy that vehicle, cannot even afford a given vehicle,
yes.
I want to see everything.
Right.
That's part of the show,
yes.
Of auto show.
Correct. And the show owners understand that. And so the way in which they're addressing that, besides changing the format, is they're finding ways to reduce the costs. Because when you go to a large Tier 1 auto show, the expense for an OEM to create what you see in Detroit or in Paris or in Frankfurt is not insignificant. So the show organizers can help by lowering the costs for the manufacturers to be in the shows.
I want to get back into that topic, but we got to take a quick commercial break and give a shout out to our great friends at BorgWarner.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
All right, we're back talking with Craig Ehrlich from George P. Johnson all about auto shows. We got a couple of questions here. I want to get back into this cost thing in a minute. But SubGR77 says, with augmented and virtual reality, how much longer will big shows have a place?
Well, big shows are always going to have a place. There's nothing that can replace holding onto the metal or the plastic, whatever the case might be. You just can't replace it.
The carbon fiber, right.
Carbon fiber. You can't replace that. And VR and AR will enhance that experience. It will help you get there, but it's just like a conference. You know, nothing can replace sitting on the bar stool next to a guy, right, as a journalist, you know, and having a conversation face-to-face. And that's what the show allows you to do. It allows you to experience the product and others that are interested in the product in a more direct way than a VR AR can. So we look at those as ways to enhance the experience before, during, and after the show, but never to replace it.
Look, this is why designers still make clay models. They can simulate everything. They can create whatever in virtual reality. They all say there's nothing like rubbing your hand on that thing, even if it's made out of clay, to get a feel for the design.
Mm-hmm.
But let's go back to cost, because one of the things that I always liked about the Detroit show is the quality of the exhibits was the best in the country.
Yeah.
Better than L.A., New York, definitely better than Chicago, but expensive. And especially because they had to build these things up over the Christmas holidays. You're paying double or triple overtime in some cases.
Yeah.
If that's going away, doesn't that hurt the visual appeal of the show?
Well, it doesn't, because at the same time, and when you say it's going away, what's going away is we're reducing the amount of time that it takes to install.
Mm-hmm.
You're changing the time of year, which will require less overtime and double time. And equally, if not more important, companies like George P. Johnson are investing in technologies to make these exhibits lighter, to make them easier to set up. We're working, you know, doing 3D printing on a lot of the...
Is that right?
Absolutely. A lot of the exhibits and a lot of the componentry that we're using. And all of that is reducing our costs for our customers, reducing the time that it takes to set it up, which is where a lot of the money and the cost is.
Sure.
And so our clients would not, and wouldn't expect them to skimp on the quality. We got to find better ways to do it. Another way we do it is by investing in the equipment. We have over 1 million square feet in this country of fabrication and graphics and engineering prowess. And so
that's a lot.
It's a lot.
So another one of the areas that you work in is in Japan. We talked about this before the show started, and you go over there periodically, and you do work with Nissan. And so George P. Johnson helped with the global launch of the Nissan Leaf.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking here about, you know, getting media views and so on. So you held this event. You had 5,600 attendees, 515,000 live streams, over 500,000 YouTube views, 4,000 media mentions, and 66,000 social posts with 1.1 billion impressions, okay? If you can do that for one car, why do you need an auto show?
Well, Well, that's the launch of one vehicle, but there were a very finite number of people that got to actually touch and feel that vehicle. So we don't look at it as it's one or the other. This was launched outside of an auto show, mm-hmm. right? So what, maybe the question is, why do you need the show to launch that vehicle? And really, we could not have done what we did in the launch of that inside of the 15 minutes that you have in a show. You just can't do it. There are plenty of launches that are appropriate for that. And there is a place, a very strong place in our industry for the actual show. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Leaf launch, which we also tied to a U.S. dealer meeting. So, this thing was broadcast around the world with those statistics, as you can imagine. We have 30 offices around the world. So in Japan, our office can engage and we can make sure that, we're able to execute flawlessly wherever we are. And this is one of the things that we're able to do with Leaf. Mm-hmm. George B. Johnson is also part of Project Worldwide, which is a holding company of 14 agencies. And those 14 agencies are all complementary agencies. And in the case of the Leaf launch, I bring that up because one of our sister agencies, SpinFX, who focuses on content and digital content, worked with us together with Nissan on creating a lot of the imagery that you saw in the launch of that Leaf, from the projection mapping and whatnot. And what's really cool about GPJ is when you buy or when a manufacturer works with GPJ, they actually get all of these agencies together, all the creative of all these agencies, all the strategy of all these agencies, all the services of these agencies. So whether it's a company like SpinFX that is doing digital marketing or a company like G7, which is our entertainment marketing agency down in Nashville that, works with the likes of RAM and some of the activations we have in the country music space, or a company like Praytel, which is our PR and social media agency. We have a really cool connection of collaborative agencies to help our clients more than just the fabrication of a show.
Craig, it seems to me that auto shows have not even scratched the surface of what they could become. Mm-hmm. I think there could be a far more entertainment for the public. You guys did a dynamite display event last year. I think it was last year at the New York show for the Dodge Demon. Mm-hmm. Even lit them up right in the warehouse that you guys had down by the river. It was an awesome event.
Yeah.
And all I could think of is the public would kill to be here.
Yeah.
And we've seen other shows, this great entertainment done for the media that I think is largely lost on the media. We're hard-bitten, cynical journalists who are just there for the news.
Sure.
And all this entertainment would seem to me that there is an opportunity for auto shows, at least from the public day standpoint, to become far bigger than they are today.
No question about it. They won't be recognizable to what they are today. And the Detroit show is taking a giant risk, one that they had, in my opinion, they had to do to take us there. And you need only look to places like South by Southwest or Dreamforce from Salesforce I talk about to see how it's being done outside of the auto sector. So, it's being kind of viewed as an auto show, but it's going to be a festival. And you're going to see, live music stages, and you're going to see, TED-like talks around the city, and think about all the other brands, non-automotive related, that will want to participate in this, right? 800,000 people, the general public coming through. It's just, you are absolutely right, just scratching the surface.
I think if the auto shows do it right, and let's focus on Detroit for a minute, 800,000 is going to be nothing. I think you could have people planning their vacations around the auto show that offered this wide variety of entertainment.
Absolutely. I mean, look at this weekend we'll have a million people filling Woodward Avenue.
For the Dream Cruise.
And imagine a combination of the Dream Cruise and the auto show and a concert series and things like that. You're right. We are simply scratching the surface, and GPJ is working hard. We have an army of strategists right now that are working on how best our customers can best take advantage of that, and of course, how the city can do that as well.
How do you do it for the journalists? As you mentioned, great move to go to June. The public days are going to be phenomenal, but how do you change that whole experience for the journalists? Because, you know, one of the reasons the Detroit Show really had to move is it was losing so much coverage to CES. I mean, that's where journalists were going. Right. And I got to tell you, somebody who goes to CES every year, it ain't a great show. It really isn't. I mean, it's become this wonder thing that people feel they've got to be there. But as a journalist there, I can tell you the experience is no better than any other place.
Right.
It's not that much better, even though it's in Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are your ideas for how you make auto shows a magnet for the media again?
Well, the way it becomes a magnet is the same way it's always become a magnet, and that is access, right? And you guys would know that better than most, right? I would ask you that question, but what we believe is creating access that no one else can have. And when you have when you can spread out, and you can take a little more time, you can create that access, that unusual access. So, you know, going outside of the venue is one way to do that. You were at the Demon launch. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a 2-hour, 3-hour experience.
At least, right.
And John, when we were there, it seemed like the public was there. There were so many
people.
There were so many people there.
Yeah. And they weren't all journalists either. I don't know who they were, but it was jam-packed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when Wiz Khalifa is on the DJ stand, you got to expect you're going to get a variety of folks.
That's exactly
right.
Do you find that your clients, the auto companies, are more receptive to doing things like that than they may have been 10, 15 years ago? I mean, that they recognize that there needs to be other elements that would be a magnet to draw people in?
Yeah. The automakers in everything that they're doing are more progressive. And the industry itself is changing. It's under such radical pressure to change, whether you're talking about electrification or autonomy. All of those changes are, they're kind of like, you know, spreading throughout the organization. So marketers are willing to take more risks. At the same time, the marketing organization itself and the CMOs are rising in the organization. And because of that, they're controlling, you know, more of the spend. Mm-hmm. And then last, certainly not least, everything is more measurable today than it's ever been. And so when you can demonstrate that an experience is creating some lift in the perception of a brand or the views that you referenced online, then it's a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm. The all-important ROI.
The all-important ROI.
Hey, we got a Wright Knight and SubGR wrote back, and they're both saying the same thing. Wright Knight says, auto shows used to be dream factories. SubGR says, I'd like to see more concept cars. Boy, if I had a dollar for everybody in the public who said, I want to see more concept cars, I'd have a lot of money right now.
Yeah.
I know you guys are not exactly telling the automakers what to do, but wouldn't you love to tell them, hey, the public loves dream cars or concept cars.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I love concept cars, too. We all do, right? It's fun. And we see quite a few of them, maybe not at the same level that you did 30 years ago. And maybe that's because the cars become real much faster.
Right.
The other thing, though, is they're expensive to make. Yeah. And automakers don't like spending a dime on anything unless there's an ROI behind it. And to do a concept car that's just a dream car, I mean, they want to whet the public's appetite for something that they can buy.
Right.
But, you know, we've degenerated, and I'm not going to name a company's name right now, but their concept cars are essentially production vehicles with the mirrors and the door handles taken off them. They're not concept cars at all.
Right.
And what the public wants is, take me on a trip, a dream trip of what's going to be in the future. That's what they want to see.
But isn't it conceivable that one of the roles that you guys play in creating these experiences is to take the real product that people can buy and position them in such a way that they become the dream car, that somebody can say, hey, I can actually buy this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, showing people different settings and different backgrounds and different formats and mm-hmm. you know, just create this experience that's like, damn, I want to buy one of those.
Yeah, well, and to that point, it's all about personalization. Like, you know, everyone wants to know what's in it for me and how is this uniquely personal to me. And so we create experiences, take them on a journey that allows them for example, to choose everything that they would want about a vehicle, and it does. It becomes their dream vehicle by doing just that. But our job isn't to say, you need a concept car on there. Our job is to understand the goals and objectives, and that could be a vehicle. It could also be about electrification. It could be about, you know, intelligent mobility. It could be about anything. It doesn't necessarily have to be about a car. Ultimately, it all ties back in, but our job is to help tell the stories that the manufacturer wants the general public and consumers and the press to know about their brand and both where they are and where they're going.
See, this is fascinating to hear you talk about it, because in my mind, George P. Johnson was always the carpenters and the drywallers and the electricians and all those guys that would hammer and nail and saw and paint and build these beautiful exhibits.
Yeah.
Walk us through a little bit. How long does it take you to get together with a client, plan out what's going to be done, build the whole thing, and put it out there?
Yeah. So, by the way, we are still those carpenters and those engineers and those craftsmen.
And artists, too. I mean, you have some people doing some amazing stuff.
Amazing stuff. But over the years, over the 104 years that we've been in business, we've developed so much deeper and really is unique place for us in the industry, because we're on the floor with other exhibitors, that's what they do. They put, you know, the hammer and the nail together and they're done. But our work starts, you know, well over a year in advance of a activation, where we're working on the strategy. We're working deep inside the organization to understand what it is they're looking to communicate. And we call that kind of like our discovery phase of everything. And then we dream. Right, and our creative team, we have 8 studios around the country, and we're dreaming about how we can make this strategy come alive. And then we build, right? And then last, and certainly not least, we deliver. And so it's been a quite of...
It can be a year-long project.
It could be a year-long project, and it could also be 60 days. Time frames for us, like any other industry, have shrunk. And the investments in technology that I was mentioning before, whether that's in technology in the shops, whether that's in technology and software to help to create a more agile organization that can move more quickly, whichever way it is, like we... are not unlike a manufacturer needing to bring a vehicle to market faster than ever before. And so sometimes we have a year, sometimes we don't.
Yeah. What is the makeup of a team that would work on something that, you know, we would see at the auto show? I mean, what are the types of people that are behind that to deliver what we see?
Yeah. So it depends on all the services that a client might be using relative to an auto show or a conference or whatever the case might be. But there's always a, you know, someone from our strategy team that's involved in setting that strategy. We always have a creative team, which includes 3D designers, 2D designers, art directors, copywriters, all of those. Because, you know, our messaging extends far beyond kind of the floor of the exhibit in the case of auto shows. We have a very deep, knowledgeable base of client service teams that in some cases have been 30-plus years in the industry and in the brands, right? We've seen many regimes at different auto manufacturers, and we stay the constant, and it's a great value to our clients. And then we touch into our teams included in engineering to do the drawings and the floor planning and those types of things. We have project managers that are making sure that everything's going through the shop. Recently, in the last 2 years and continuing, we're going through a modernization effort where we're deploying tools one tool we use is called Smartsheet. And it's basically like an Excel spreadsheet on steroids that has accountability across it. And so our project management team uses that to hold everyone accountable, including clients who have visibility and a portal into these sheets and dashboards related to, you know, everything about their project to help, create full transparency for them.
You guys are really almost like an advertising agency.
We are.
But instead of making ads on TV or radio, you're creating experiences and exhibits.
I couldn't have said it better myself, John. Thank you.
I mean, just as you were talking about it, it struck me, man, you almost sound like an agency.
We are a full-service agency.
Yeah.
Absolutely full-service agency. And with the Project Worldwide Network, we can do those ads because Argonaut on the West Coast, that they make television commercials.
Okay, one second. Kevin just wrote in to say, I'm a college student, was on your website, meaning George P. Johnson's. It says you're hiring. GPJ looks like it has awesome benefits. I want to work for you. Do you think that breeds creativity?
Great question. Thank you. We are hiring. We're hiring around the country. And we love people that are passionate about the business. GPJ's secret, we have great benefits, by the way, including we're employee owned. So all the employees of the company own the company. And George P. Johnson's family, who became the Valley family through marriage, and still to this day, the CEO and the president of our holding company are
in the family.
Are in the family.
So 100 years it's been in the family.
That's right.
Pretty good.
But about 12 or 13 years ago, the family decided to sell the company to the employees, and they created an ESOP. And I'm not sure how much you know about ESOPs, but
Employee stock ownership plan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. So the employees own the company, and it really makes a difference to the customers because the decisions that I'm making every day are decisions about my own money. And so because of that, sometimes we do things differently. At the same time, we're not publicly held. So we're not making decisions or how are we going to make our quarterly numbers and things like that. So because of that, we take care of ourselves, right? And our benefits are unbelievable. And what it ends up doing is attracting the most passionate, the most collaborative, and the most fearless people that are in this business.
That's a great point for us to take another segue here because we've got to give another shout out to our great sponsors, Lear and Bridgestone.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking about all kinds of things auto show related and beyond with Craig Ehrlich from George P. Johnson. But the show would not be a show, and I'm talking about our show, Gary, without Dr. Data making an appearance.
Okay, so Craig will be, this will be his first time out. And so this is a very easy thing to guess. Okay, so I'm going to give you some numbers up here, and it's very topical. And you may get it like this.
Okay. So I did win Jeopardy 1 year.
You really?
No.
Oh. Okay, so please bring up the first number. Okay, so this is 80,000 versus 13,587, 17 million versus 8.5 million.
Yowza. Well, the 17 million would seem to be roughly...
And they're both related. They're both numbers. The sets
that are related. Well, the 17 million, I would guess, is car sales in the U.S. We've been running at around a 17 million unit rate. But 8.5 million, I have no idea.
I guess it would be a year, 50 years ago or something. Is it a comparison to another year?
Okay, so yes, John, you are right about the 17.5 million being the car sales. That has nothing to do with car sales.
Huh.
And this was in the news within the last week.
And 80,000 versus 13,587. In the last week.
This is big news. This is very controversial. And it has to do with, I'll give you another hint, mobility.
Mobility.
Yeah.
So.
It's like password, mobility.
Huh. I'm still struggling here. Mobility.
Boy, Katie did a very good job of hiding what's back there.
I think there was there some news about millennial preferences on ride sharing?
That's true, too, but.
Not related, huh?
That's not it.
It's related, but it's wrong. All right.
Okay.
Bring up the answer, please. So the first number is the number of for-hire vehicle drivers versus medallion taxis in New York City.
So you're saying sort of like Uber versus yellow cab.
Uber versus yellow cab. And so then the other was the number of rides each month in New York City. So meaning both of those numbers that were the bigger numbers, like the 17 million number.
And
okay.
Back up. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the number of rides, and then you can see the number of medallion holders. And so as you may recall, the city of New York put a cap on the number of licenses for the for-hire vehicles. So basically what they want to do is not allow there to be more Uber drivers, which is driving the number of medallion taxi owners way down, which is causing all kinds of economic hardship.
If I was a medallion holder, if I was a yellow cab guy with I would sue the city of New York because me pay, if you go back just 8 years ago, I had to pay $1 million to buy that medallion. Mm-hmm. And now you let Uber and Lyft and everybody else come in, and now my medallion's worth less.
So now you wouldn't sue New York because New York is basically saying, this is not a good thing, right? So that's why they put
this is a Band-Aid de Blasio's putting on there. It's not going to work. I think they have destroyed the value of these medallions as soon as they let Uber and Lyft and everybody else.
But it would be interesting to know how many individual people, how many John McElroys went out and scratched up the money to buy a medallion versus how many Michael Cohens bought a whole bunch of medallions and, you know, use it as an investment property versus using it as a means by which they're able to do their job. And I have a feeling that the initial idea was, okay, you know, we will give you the opportunity to do work and as an individual, and it turned into something that it was never meant to be.
I'd still sue them.
I know you'd sue them. It's litigious.
If you were making vinyl albums when digital music came around.
But see, that's different. That's a technology disruption, as opposed to a city municipality that says, if you want to do business, you have to buy this certificate, in this case, a medallion. And we, the city, will sell this to you. And as you know, for years, you could go to the bank with it. Literally, you could go to the bank and say, I need to take a loan out to buy a medallion. Mm-hmm. And now, by the city allowing competitors to go in and compete against you without having to buy a medallion, you destroyed these people's livelihoods. I don't blame Uber and Lyft at all, just as I don't blame the digital disruption to vinyl.
Yeah.
And vinyl's making somewhat of a comeback that way.
All right. So speaking of things litigious, today was a very important, interesting day in history. In 1984, John DeLorean of the DeLorean Motor Company was found not guilty in L.A. court for smuggling drugs, and it turned out that they were able to show that it was entrapment. And I thought what was very interesting about that was allegedly the drug smuggling was in order to make money to put into his car company.
Right.
So
he wasn't doing it for himself directly, right?
Well, I don't think he was necessarily doing it, but isn't that bizarre to think about? I mean, a guy who's running a car company that is, you know, accused of smuggling drugs so he can get money to, you know, like buy spark plugs. You know what I mean? It was.
I never thought of it that way.
Or flux capacitors, as the picture of the DMC-12 there, which was used in Back to the Future, seems to indicate. But,
No, I remember the day that John DeLorean got busted. I was at a Volkswagen event out in California. And, of course, none of us were talking about Volkswagen as soon as the news broke. All we were talking about was John C. DeLorean dealing in cocaine.
And to his credit, he's the guy who was behind the development of the Pontiac GTO, so he should go down in history for providing Marty McFly, what was the character's name in Back to the Future? It doesn't matter. But that time machine.
There's a bunch of people screaming at us right now.
That's right.
Know the answer.
So the time machine and the GTO, John DeLorean.
Yeah. Hey, we also got a phone call here, too. Carmen, let's bring that in.
Hi, John and the crew. It's going to be a great show today, I'm sure. What are your guys' predictions for the Chevrolet Lordstown plant? They're down to one shift right now. Is there even a slight chance they may make maybe a small crossover? And why didn't Chevrolet GM make the hatchback up there in that plant instead of down in the Mexico plant? It doesn't bode well for the plant, just like the smaller plants for Ford car, the Focus. So what's your educated guess or your best theory? Thanks very much. Have a good show, and stay cool there in Michigan. My name is Paul. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Paul. Gary, you want to start on that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if you look at Lordstown, you know, making small cars, compact cars, is not a very good business right now for anyone, right? So, you know, you have the tooling, you have the capacity, you have that whole thing there, and then the Cruise hatch is what he's referring to that is being made in the Mexican plant. I think that, you know, you may be looking at something that will be as much motivated by politics as economics in terms of what they're going to do. I mean, so, for example, you know, the Buick Envision is brought in from China, and General Motors is trying to appeal the tariff on that, since it's a, you know, an import from China, and trying to get that put aside for that vehicle. So isn't it conceivable that they would basically say, hey, we're going to keep this plant in Ohio open in order to, you know, do some other things? So that's why I think politics and economics are going to be something that will be very close together. And, you know, why did they put the hatch in Mexico in the first place? Well, it made sense when they did that. I mean, it's a that was an economic decision.
Yeah, it was. But it's a good question. What's going to happen with the Lordstown plant? Because as Paul just mentioned, it's down to one shift. You can't make money on a plant at one shift, not making entry-level cars. And that's not the only problem plant that GM has on its hands. The Detroit plant, Detroit Hamtramck, is operating on one shift. The Orion plant is operating on one shift. I mean, ideally, you'd put all that production into one plant and work mega overtime. But that's kind of the situation that GM's in right now. Car sales, as we know, continue to crater, passenger car sales. Ford has said, forget about it. We're out of this business, with the exception of the Mustang, essentially. GM has said, no. We're sticking with this. We believe in it. What they need to do is add other products in those plants, get a second shift in there so that you can make money on them. But what are you going to do? I mean, you know, there's a big hullabaloo right now that they should have put the new Chevy Blazer into Lordstown instead of building it in Mexico. But a lot of people don't realize you can't just say, oh, yeah, well, let's put that vehicle in that plant. It takes mega planning, mega tooling. Right. It's a lot of work. It's not like a snap decision. But I got to believe that GM right now is looking at its manufacturing footprint and trying to figure out how do we get these plants back on two shifts, or which one's going to close.
So, I mean, isn't there the possibility, I mean, there's like a third alternative, which will take more time even, conceivably, but to come out with a car that people really want to buy, okay? A sensational, a dream car, as it were. I mean, look, I mean, Honda's doing pretty well with its...
Yeah,
with
but its, Honda's got a great brand, and Honda approaches the business differently than any other automaker.
But people like to buy Civics.
No, they do. Exactly right. And Honda, my hat's off to them. They're able to make entry-level cars in America and make a profit on them. But the domestics don't have that brand equity in passenger cars. In certain models, Mustang, Camaro, Corvette, that sort of thing, yeah, they can make it. But when you want to go head-to-head against Toyota and Honda and the like, their brand just doesn't carry the premium that allows them to make money on those vehicles.
And therein lies the challenge.
It does. No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, look, I've driven the Chevy Cruze. It's a pretty good car. I'd stack it up very favorably to a Honda. But it doesn't matter even if it's better than the Honda. It'll take 20 years before the public catches on to the fact that, hey, that Chevy's better, and by then it's too late.
And does it exist in 20 years?
No, probably not. Mm. I don't think it does. But
therein lies the problem.
Yeah. Right. It really does. So, Gary, what else is in the news this week that we should talk about?
Well, I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I don't know that we've ever talked about land speed records, but I thought it was very interesting that...
There's an experiential event for you guys.
Like
land speed record.
Let's go.
So Mickey Thompson set the land speed record for a piston-driven vehicle, not a jet-powered vehicle. The son of Danny, that you know the famous Danny Thompson. Danny won. Mickey's dead.
Mickey was the dad.
People are writing in more than my missing on the name of Doc, whatever his name is. But like Jesus, what's he talking about? But
I think it was just Doc. Hey, Doc.
No, it was Doc.
Danny Thompson.
Doc Brown.
Okay.
Doc Brown. Thank you, Sean.
So he had a combined 448.75 miles per hour in a vehicle.
In a piston-driven engine.
Two nitro-fueled 2,500 horsepower Hemi engines. I mean, can you just imagine that, you know, like doing that? And it's sort of striking in a good way that there are still people who say, you know what, I'm going to take a car and make it as powerful as I possibly can do and go as fast as I can to show that it can be done. You know, I mean, and there's something to be said to these guys like the Thrust SSC that are trying to, you know, make jet-powered things. But you know what, for people who are just driving cars that have engines and, you know, guys who have cars that have Hemis, you know, they're probably like, yeah, this is really, really quite cool.
Yeah.
And so you got to give a shout-out to that guy for doing that. It's,
sure do.
It's very impressive.
It's cool to see that people are still trying to break the land speed record and getting sponsors to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. That's got to be the hardest part.
So what's your take on Tesla? We were not doing a show last week when the word came out that Elon seemed to be thinking about taking the company private.
Well, I want to ask Craig. I'll jump in. But they do media extravaganzas like no other company. Have you guys been involved with Tesla?
We have. Yeah.
No kidding. So when they have the electric semi truck and all the adulating fans of Elon Musk, that's an event that you guys have put together.
Well, they work with a variety of agencies. We've been fortunate enough to be one of them over the years. And mm-hmm. so I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but, you know, we work with almost all the manufacturers.
What's the deal? Why does Tesla, and now Audi's going to do an event next month, too, starting at 8 p.m. on the West Coast? What's the thinking? Is this for the Chinese news cycle? Because everybody in Europe's in bed. The whole East Coast is mm-hmm. is not tuning into this mm-hmm. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Why do they do it that late at night on the West Coast?
I don't know the answer. My presumption would be it's for the global world, right? You can't. We have this issue with 30 offices around the world. Who's going to be up in the middle of the night on a call, right? Somebody's
caught out.
Somebody's in their pajamas in the office.
Yeah.
Exactly. Somebody's not putting their WebEx camera on.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? And so maybe that's the reason why. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how the story plays out. You know, Elon said, hey, I'm going to take the company private. I got all the funding. Now, a week later, we're not sure that he really does have all the funding. The SEC wants to investigate. Who knows?
But, I mean, what do you think of the idea? Okay, let's say that, you know, there's, you know, the allegedly that there's a Saudi sovereign wealth fund that is going to put money into this thing and allow him to take it private. I mean, does it make sense in this day and age for an auto company to go private?
Yes, it does.
And why would that be?
Well, you know, very interestingly, it was exactly 100 years ago to this year.
99 years.
That, you're going to be next year. Henry Ford took the Ford Motor Company private. He bought out all his investors. He bought it with his own money. And he could do that because the Ford Motor Company at the time, this is 1919, you're right, it was 99 years ago.
I'm right on something today.
Yeah. was obscenely profitable at the time. I mean, they were just minting money. Ford was the number one car company in the world. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that it had over 50% market share in 1919. So Henry was able to take it private, didn't have to listen to anybody, say, no, I don't think you should do that. No, he could do whatever he wanted. So I think that's what Elon's looking at, is he's investing in things that have got a long-term return horizon. So if you can get rid of these nagging analysts who are asking you every 3 months, hey, how'd you close the books? What are the numbers? Get rid of all that stuff. It makes a lot of sense. The downside, of course, is you go into the stock market. Why? Because now you can raise money through equity. So if you pull out of that, those days are over. Now you're totally beholden to investors and sovereign wealth funds to be able to raise the money. Mm-hmm. But I think Elon is, and I don't think you can underestimate this, he is highly, highly motivated to destroy all the investors who have been shorting his stock. I mean, this, if he does pull this off, is going to wipe out all the short positions.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, an interesting fact about the Henry Ford taking the Ford Motor Company private, that what had happened was the Dodge brothers, who had invested in the Ford Motor Company, sued Henry Ford,
right,
because they claimed that the dividends that they were paying out weren't high enough. And the reason the dividends weren't high enough was because Henry Ford was keeping the price of the Model T low. So the Dodge brothers said to him, you've got to raise the price of the car. And Henry said no, so they sued him. And Henry appealed because he lost. He appealed. He lost again. So being a clever man, he basically said, I'm going to start my own company, which caused
another company aside from the Ford Motor Company
to compete with the Ford Motor Company. And people said, holy moly, if Henry starts this other company, the value of the Ford Motor Company without Henry Ford will not be what it is. And therefore, he was able to parlay and buy the stock. And I'm sure the Dodge brothers said, you know, to hell with this. We don't deal with
this. Well, they were making engines for him, I believe, right?
Well, they had started out as a supplier, but then they ended up being an investor in the company.
Right. And
those wild Dodge
also
boys.
Some of the backdrop is the Dodges started to get the idea that, hey, we can make more than just engines. Mm-hmm. And Henry supposedly got whiff of that. And the Dodges, and Henry was saying, you know, I don't need to buy engines. And supposedly the Dodge brothers got whiff of that. So they both knew they could end up competing against each other. And that's when things started to turn sour. And that's when the Dodges said, look at the profits you're making. You know, you need to spend more on the dividend.
So the thing is that, I mean, so we're able to talk about guys like Henry Ford and the Dodge brothers and things like that. I mean, they were truly characters, right? I mean, they were characters in this industry. And pretty much now, I mean, with the passing of Sergio, I mean, we've got Elon, right?
Elon is the biggest character in this industry. And he ranks right up there with some of the greats like the Dodge brothers and Henry Ford. There's no question. He is of the same cloth they were.
Mm-hmm.
Entrepreneurial, strong-headed, and big risk takers.
So Craig, you mentioned earlier the Dream Cruise is going to be happening here in Detroit this weekend, and like a million people are going to be up and down Woodward Avenue, like the original Woodward Avenue. I mean, the street that was the basis of this industry in many ways. How does something like that happen? I mean, it basically started out as a fundraiser to get money for a ballpark or something that, you know, in Royal Oak. And now, I mean, it's bringing people from all over the world.
Yeah, it's really amazing how it's happened, because unlike most major events, there are no walls around the Woodward Dream Cruise. There are no fences. There's no ticket gate, right? And it's been completely organic the way it's grown. In fact, there were years that there's nine cities that, you know, that it goes through really struggled paying for it because they weren't getting any revenue, yet the cleanup and the policing that needed to take place. Despite all of that, there's such an incredible love for the automobile in America that it brings this, Dream Cruise here to be what it is, and it's really a magnificent weekend, you know, especially if you're obviously a car guy.
Is there anything like this that you're aware of in the world that is like this?
There are some events around the country that do things like this, but nothing of this size nor scale.
Yeah, because what are the numbers? 70 or 80,000 classic cars, a million people. Mm-hmm. Those are big numbers.
Big numbers.
Yeah. My favorite part is looking for the weirdo stuff. You know, you see a lot of 60s muscles cars, and I love that sort of stuff. But after a while, it's like, okay, how many Corvettes and Mustangs and Camaros and Chargers and whatnot can you look at? I suppose I can look at a lot. It's the really weirdo stuff that I love keeping an eye out for.
Sure.
Stuff that's really rare.
Like the DMC 12? Of which there are only 9,000 made.
That's right. Well, hey, look, we're at the top of the hour, a little beyond that, so we're going to have to wrap this up. I'll just read this. 3D House says, taking my two boys to their first Dream Cruise on Saturday. And Wright Knight wants to know, will Out of Line Detroit be at the Dream Cruise? I'll be driving down there, yeah, but none of the shows will be there this year. But anyway, just had to get those in. They just came in over the transom. Craig Erling from George P. Johnson, thanks for sitting out the show with us here. Great to hear what you guys are doing. I learned a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Good deal. And then, Gary, we got to keep on doing this sort of stuff.
Doing next week.
Okay. You're on. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.